just heard. You might want some pills. Kilo Mike 4, Kilo Papa Victor. In Lexington, Kentucky, K2LIW. Go right ahead, David.
This is KM4KPV. I can't thank you enough. I think the next step for us is there is a DMR repeater in a town called Lawrenceburg, which is only about, oh, I guess about 15 miles from here, maybe 20 miles. And so I think we ought to reach out to them. They've got this set up actually at the Emergency Operations Center. As luck would have it, the Ham Club, all the equipment is owned by the EOC over there. So they've got some really nice equipment and a really nice tower. So perhaps you ought to reach out to them, see if we can hit it from here, about approximately 18, 20 miles away, and then see if I can get some interest at our Bluegrass Amateur Radio Society Club. At that point, get some more guys together and get back on a net with you guys and ask questions. Back to Ned.
Okay, Eric, you might have some further words for David, KE2EJ, after the beeps, K2LIW.
Now, you should have no problem getting into the repeater. You're only 15 miles away. I would recommend that you get in contact with one of those folks and have them come and demonstrate the radio to you and what they can do, and you'll get a really good idea.
Any further questions, David?
Do you have any specific recommendations on a radio to start out with that does DMR?
Oh, there's dozens of them. There's a company called Communication Systems, CSC. There's TYT, which is Chinese, which is actually, there's some interesting firmware for it that actually handles the whole DMR database. And then, of course, there's Motorola, Moto Turbo, it's all the same thing. There's, I think Baofeng is coming out with one that's not quite ready yet. And then there's another Chinese company. There's a lot of selections. You know, the Motorola is in terms of the high-end dollars, and the TYT you can get off of Amazon for like $100 and something real cheap. And there's variations in between. So, again, talk to the folks that are actually using it, and you will get a lot of different input.
Eric, do you know of any pitfalls so far? Is there any particular pieces of hardware that you should not buy at this time that you know is troublesome? KE2EJ, K2IW.
No, as with anything, because this is really a software-based kind of radio, most of the radios are built around a Texas Instrument OMAP chip. And the voice software itself is it's a proprietary piece of software that runs the vocoder, so that's pretty much similar amongst all the other radios. But as with anything, the newer Chinese radios, you got to wait a little while until they get the software bugs out, but you'll find that there's a lot of radios out there that are very stable, very good, and very reliable.
2GS?
AC2GS, and we only heard the GS, K2RW. Go ahead, Roy.
I'm sorry, I'm still getting my circadian rhythm checked out. It's not communication systems, it's Connect systems. They make a whole line of mobile and handy talkies. One little thing that you should keep in mind is you can't really slap a Mirage amplifier on the other end of these things because it uses TDMA and time slots. It has very rapid switching and needs a very special amplifier if you plan to add one on. So you probably should figure out how much output you want and either buy a mobile or a handy talkie depending upon the output that you think you'll need.
You may have heard recently, Eric, that that Steve, K-A-2-Y-H-Y, recently bought a 40-watt German-made DMR-compatible amplifier. He had it delivered about...
I pointed it out to him.
Okay. He had it delivered a week and a half to him before. He's very happy with that. So give us some words on that one Is that the only one available at this time that will boost a handy-talkie up to 40 watts? And along these lines, Eric, the second question I've got is that as local guys, I'm not on DMR, as local guys started getting their DMR radios available, that were operational, it seems like setting up the key, as they called it, was less than easy. In other words, a number of people had trouble setting up that key at first, and therefore various people volunteered to do it because the procedure didn't seem to be user-friendly from my point of view. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Thanks for the correction on Kinect systems, Roy. I got that messed up. Now, don't forget that these radios are designed for commercial service. They weren't really designed for ham. And in commercial service, the users are actually not allowed to dig into controlling the software. It's kind of against the FCC rules. So, yeah, it's a little bit convoluted in terms of the way the software is set up. But the software itself is, to be able to tune the radio, is something called, they use something called a code plug. And if you go to dmmarc.net, you will find that there's a collection of code plugs for different radios from different areas. You will find that when you get involved with DMR and you're working with a group that's already in existence, you will be able to find code plugs that are already set up. It's really not that hard, like Kinect Systems and the TYT, Titer, and some others. They give you the software to program the radio, and it just takes a little bit getting used to. It's really not that hard, but at first it looks overwhelming, but once you get into it, it's really not so bad.
And any further words on the 40-watt amplifier, the German-made amplifier? Is that the only one available at this time that's capable of switching back and forth in the right number of milliseconds? Because the DMR really is a simultaneous transmit and receive on the exact same frequency. It's time-sharing, transmitting, and receiving. I presume it's digital information of a page-like nature, so to speak. So is that German amplifier about the only one right now that you suggested to Steve? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
No, in terms of something that's reasonably priced, the German group is pretty much it. I mean, I designed one, and for me to make like 10 of them, it's just ridiculous in terms of what it costs. But, you know, if you're making hundreds of them, then you can bring the cost down. There are commercial versions, but they're very, very expensive. And it's not necessarily what a ham is going to throw money at, but the kind of money you just buy a radio with more power. But believe it or not, 5 watts can do an amazing thing. Put it into a decent antenna, you really get some excellent coverage out of the darn thing. The actual switching time, by the way, I was going to correct you, Dick. In order to transmit, you actually send out a little 2-millisecond burst that is on the transmit frequency, which the repeater picks up, then in turn sends a handshake back to you and then allows you to go into transmit. But when you're doing point-to-point, you know, on the same frequency, then each packet is 20 milliseconds long, and there's a control packet that's 2 milliseconds in between it. So in essence, it's doing handshaking on the same frequency when you're doing from radio to radio. When you're doing a repeater, it's actually each burst is at the transmit frequency, and then the repeater responds on the receive frequency. So it still switches back and forth in terms of, you know, your antenna is going from transmit to receive with the 2-millisecond safety slices or guard bands between the packets, and the packets themselves are 20 milliseconds long.
Thank you for coming. I'll pick up comment in a minute. I thank you for that, Eric. What a Lexicon, Metropolitan Lexington, Kentucky, and Metropolitan New York City probably have a strong degree of similarity. Therefore, I'm going to guess that David would like to know the following. A 5-watt handy-talkie with a good mag mount antenna on top of a vehicle in Metropolitan New York, what kind of range that it'll give you? And a 50-watt radio with a mag mount antenna, mobile, to a DMR radio. Roughly what kind of range are we getting in New York City and quite possibly Lexington will be somewhat similar. KE2EJ, K2LAW, go ahead, Eric.
So, a 5-wire radio on an antenna on the roof of your car. We got guys traveling all over the place. I mean, we do have multiple repeaters, so when you get nasty into one, you can switch over to another. But, you know, you're looking at 25, 30 miles without anything really negative happening. But again, that all depends upon terrain. And if you've got big buildings, you've got multipath and that kind of thing, you know, because it is a digital symbol, if you want to think of it that way.
Okay, the biggest variable will be altitude of the repeater. The DMR repeaters that you're able to get 25-mile range with reasonable reliability, mobile to repeater, are those particular DMR repeaters on a 100-foot building or a 1,000-foot building? Over to you, Eric, K2EJ, K2IW.
Now, we're kind of spoiled rotten out here. I mean, you know, what's the height of Glen Oaks? We were talking about the height of my tower. Actually, my tower is pretty good. Let's see, I get way past your house with 5 watts, and I make it all the way to the Cross Island, so that'll give you a little bit of an idea.
Yeah, his tower is something like 580 feet above sea level. Glen Oaks is something like, let me think, 300 foot for the building, 300 foot for the land. It's again 600 and some odd feet above sea level. So it'll give you some idea. I'm going to pick up the comment person, then I'm going to go back to David if he's got any further questions or fills. A person who said comment, who was that? K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
K2RIW, this is KC2SHO, John, from Los Alamos, New Mexico. Had a comment on the amplifier solution.
We're all ready for your comment on the amplifier solution, John. Wait for the beeps and go right ahead.
Yeah, Dick, I was running the Kinect Systems handheld in the car. And, you know, it worked pretty good with the, you know, with the standard output. And someone one day handed me a TPL amplifier. Now, this is one of the commercial brands, as Eric had mentioned, that you can get. And fortunately, you can find these used. I can tell you the model number that worked for me. But, boy, did that really change everything. It gave me a very, you know, mobile-like feeling when I was using the handheld in the car. So the brand is TPL. The model that worked for me was Paul Alpha 6-1 Alpha Boy Lima. So that's Tom Paul Lima is the brand. Paul Alpha 6-1 Alpha Boy Lima for the model. And that's a UHF only, but that worked great for me. And you can find these used on eBay. I picked up two more recently just to put them in the kit here and have them as backups, and they work wonderful. These are the units that are used in the public service or police or whatever you want to call it, the public safety sector, where they dock their Motorola radios. This is what's on the other end of that dock. K4IW, KC2SHO, I hope that's helpful.
Very fine, John. That came through very well. So, David, in case you weren't able to copy all of this, you probably would like to know that everything you've heard has been recorded. It will be played back in a few days, if you want, on the site of amateurradio.tangovictor, www.amateurradio.tangovictor. The last 10 years worth of TechNet are recorded. So within a few days from now, you'll be able to play back this recording if you want some fills. But if you want to ask some further questions right now, go right ahead. Kilo Mike 4, Kilo Papa Victor, K2RIW. Go ahead, David.
This is KM4KTV. I just want to thank all of you. This is just absolutely wonderful. Once again, the Long Island Amateur Radio Club has not let me down with a plethora of informative people. I'm going to reach out to the folks in Lawrenceburg that have this repeater. It's got good elevation. Their antenna, their tower's got good elevation, so I think this might work well for us. So in the interim, 73 to everybody, and thank you so much.
Glad you were happy with the information you got to tonight, David. Yeah, in order to join this club, you got to pass an IQ test, and you got to be above 130. Hey, believe that, and I'll tell you another. Okay. Hey, with any further questions or comments, any late check-ins for the TechNet, give me a call with his name right now, K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, there being none, I think it's time we go over to the space report. So Paul, WS2N, our space expert, is going to give us what I think is space report number 264. WS2N, K2RIW, you've got it, Paul.
Very good, Dick. This is WS2N, and naturally, number one is going to be the eclipse for tomorrow, of course. And that's what most people are going to be thinking about tomorrow if they watch the news. That's what they're going to be talking about. So, for New York anyway, it's going to be starting at, it's going to be really eclipsing at 2:44, but New York City. And then 1:23, it'll actually officially start. And then it'll be over by 4. And for Ron Cockman here in my area, it's 1 minute later, so there is 1 minute difference between everything that happens in New York and what happens out east in Suffolk County. So the total eclipse will be, well, not the total, but for us, a little over 70% will be at 2:46 p.m., I'll be watching it on a computer. I also have a welding lens I could look through. And that will be on a computer at NASA.com. Correction, NASA.gov will start at 12 o'clock and end at 4. And that will be the standard time. So, there you go, Dick. But the most important aspect is you got to watch your eyes, of course. And that goes for every day. You know, if you, I was looking at the sun today, if you just stare at it, you're going to do the same amount of damage. You know, if you keep staring at a sun without an eclipse compared to with an eclipse. And with an eclipse, you're actually going to have less light coming off the off the sun. So you have to watch that. Craig did the astronomy and Ed on Tuesday, and he covered this whole topic. And he's planning on going there somewhere, I don't know, somewhere along that line. And he'll give us a report when he gets back. I'm sure that'll be very, very interesting. The astronomy and Ed is on usually on Tuesday nights, a couple of weeks during the month. So that also starts at 8:30, and that lasts about an hour. Let me drop it. So I'm going to be interested to find out what happens today. We're going to have pretty good weather here in New York. So it's going to be partly cloudy, so I'm sure it'll be fine. For anybody who wants to view that thing. Let's see, a couple of launches, like you were saying earlier, before that went off this week. One was a Tedra satellite, tracking data relay satellite that NASA launched. The United Launch Alliance, which is really Boeing and Lockheed, are called United Launch Alliance. They launched the Atlas V down in Florida. It was a 501 configuration, but I meant it was a 5-meter diameter bearing, and no solid boosters attached to it. but they did send it to geosynchronous orbit, and it was successful. Tracking data relay satellites have been going up since, what, 1983, and this was called TDRS-M, you know, Mike, and they go through the different letters as time goes on, and after it gets successfully operational, which takes about 6 months to be operational, after they, you know, go through all the procedures, make sure everything works, if they switch it over to a number, it will become TDRS-13. I think there's only been like 3 or 4 of these things that they had to put in the graveyard, the geosynchronous graveyard, you know, putting it further out into orbit. Over all those years, they have quite a few that are still functioning. So that's the ones that, you know, you see almost 99% pictures from and communications from the International Space Station. That's what's doing it. Hubble uses a lot of different scientific NASA satellites use TDRS, and very important to them. And this will be the last of all the TDRS type satellites. This one should last until around 2025, as well as most of the other ones. After that, they plan on doing more advanced type of satellites. They're working on laser communications. You know, if you see a future satellite go up beyond that point, it'll probably have that, which is probably about 100 times at least better than RF as far as sending information back and forth. Let me drop it. So, okay, and then spacecraft that went up this week was the Dragon. Was sent up by SpaceX, launched out of Launch Complex 39A down in Florida. That's the complex that Saturn rockets used to use and shuttles. You know, about half the amount of shuttles took off from that launch complex. And SpaceX has taken it over, and they've launched quite a few flights. I mean, total this year, I think they're up to 11, and they've got like 9 more to go. They'll try to do 20 flights this year with their Falcon 9. But they launched the Dragon successfully, and 2 days later it docked with the International Space Station. So they'll bring up 6,000 to 7,000 pounds of food, science equipment, clothes, you name it. And then it will stay there for about a month. Dock to Harmony, and then after about a month they'll deorbit it. Unlike all the other cargo vessels that go up there, Cygnus, the Japanese cargo module H2, and the Russian one, Progress. You know, they will burn up after they leave the space station. Dragon is the only one that comes back, and that comes back on a heat shield and a parachute and lands in the Pacific Ocean a couple hundred miles off the coast of California. Now, there's another launch coming up from California in a couple of days from Vandenberg. They're going to be launching one for Taiwan, a very small satellite, only 1,000 pounds or so. So it's very lightweight for Falcon 9, but they're going to do it anyway because it was part of their manifest probably 6-7 years ago. They signed up with them when SpaceX was launching their single rocket engine, Falcon 1, they called it. It was advanced to Falcon 1E. And they never got this one off the ground because of they changed their, they gave up with the Falcon 1E, they just went right into the Falcon 9, and the satellite has been waiting to take off for a long, long time, so they're going to put that into polar orbit. And there's a lot more, but I just want to cover this one topic that was on the NASA site is talking about a large asteroid that's going to be passing Earth called Florence. Florence is the name of the asteroid. And it's a little over 2 miles in diameter. But it's not going to be too close to Earth, but about 4 million miles out, so. But the moon is, what, roughly a quarter of a million miles out, so it's roughly 16 times the distance of the moon. But close enough to, you know, to monitor it, and they're going to be using all kinds of radar and trying to get more accurate information about Florence as it goes by on September 1st. If you want any more topics, I'll be here, but I think that's enough for now. I'll turn it back to you. K2RIW, back to that WS2S.
Okay, if the people who are listening tonight, if you have any further questions or comments for Paul with reference to the space report, please give me your call letters right now, K2RIW, etc. You're allowed to ask anything about space. You're even allowed to ask anything with reference to the solar eclipse that's going to happen tomorrow, at starting at around 1 o'clock, but I think the peak of it is around 2:40. 243, something like our local time. We're only going to see something like 73% of the blockage. And zillions of people have spread themselves down to that streak of land between Oregon and South Carolina, where over that hour and 33 minutes, the sun will be streaking across with a full shadow, full eclipse. And boy, are those towns being jammed up right now from what I can see. And with any further questions or comments, and all of the above, give me a call with his name right now, K2RIW in the TechNet.
UB2GXM.
UB2.
Okay, I think I heard GXM, and I think it was HUC. I think it was that, but GXM, go right ahead.
Dick, and hello, Paul. This is Whiskey Bravo, 2 Golf X-Ray Mike, Rich. I've been lax in getting my glasses. I don't have glasses. I don't have a welder's helmet or whatever. And I have heard that there are recipes online for making a safe filter that you can look at the eclipse through. I'm not a big fan of the pinhole idea or projected image. I'd like to look through something safe to glimpse the eclipse. Can you recommend an online URL that would have a nice recipe for a self-made glass? WB2GXM.
I think you're into a very dangerous area here, Rich. If you're not using exactly the right materials the right way, you can get yourself in trouble. The magic of a good set of solar observation glasses is that it gives you a 100,000-to-1 darkening ratio. That's 10 to the 5th power, 10 to the minus 5 power. A 5th order neutral density filter, that's half of the requirement. The other half of the requirement is it must have at least that amount of attenuation of infrared. The sun has a lot of infrared energy that your eye does not respond to. So you could have depending on what recipe you've used, let me drop. You could have a recipe that gives you beautiful blockage of the visual light by the 100,000-to-1 ratio, 10 to the 5 power, but yet it might have only 10 to the 3 power of rejection of infrared, and the infrared energy that you're not responding to is roaring through that filter, in this worst-case scenario, and piling onto your retina and burning a hole in it, so to speak. I've done a quick calculation as to how much energy, how much power hits a tiny little dot on your retina when you have a focused eye looking at the sun. And you better not be doing it for more than a small fraction of a second, otherwise you're going to get thermal damage to the retina. So I'm very worried about somebody's recipe. But I'll pass it over to Paul, just in case he knows something, but I'd go an awful slow on that approach. When it comes to observing the sun, if you can't get a pair of those glasses, and there are various libraries on Long Island are saying they want to give out the glasses free of charge. I'm a little worried. Let me drop the phone. I'm a little worried that the glasses they're giving out free of charge are only intended for the kids that show up to their presentations at the library during the event. And so I don't think you just go walking through the door and get a free set of glasses. Other than that, binoculars and a small telescope as a projection device where you take the output from the eyepiece and project it onto a piece of paper. That can give you a very nice image. But as you get to the larger telescopes with the more modern eyepieces that have glued elements to it, you got to worry about the heat damaging your eyepiece. And even if you do have a telescope with a spotting scope alongside of it, you got to make sure you put some tinfoil over the spotting scope. Otherwise, you're going to burn out the crosshairs. So I don't think there is a reliable, safe recipe, but maybe Paul knows of one. WS2N, have you ever heard of a recipe for building your own solar filter? Over to you, Roy, Paul, WS2N, K2IW.
WS2N. No, I haven't heard of a recipe. I remember, back in 1970, it was March in New York, and, we had a similar type of eclipse. It was probably 75% or so, like this one. And I remember they would recommend to take negatives, from your camera. I guess nobody has that anymore, and put them together and use that. And I was young at the time, and my father said, "You're not doing that." He didn't trust that idea. And you put all a bunch together, and you're supposed to be able to do that, look at the sun. Really, I would say no. At that time, he had welding lenses. I have them. And that's okay. 12, 13, and a 14, they go by numbers. Would be okay. If green ones, aqua ones. The only ones that would not be okay is the late 90s, they came out with these welding shields, and they had an 9-volt battery in them. And when you strike an arc, the glass instantly turns dark. Well, you can't use that. You can't use that looking at the sun. And I never trusted those anyway. Back to you, Dick. Sorry, Rich. I can't help you on that. There's no magic recipe. Look at the computer. I'm going to look at the computer. I'll look for a second or two with the welding shield, and that's good. I'm going to leave it on from 12 o'clock to 4 o'clock. And let me drop it. I know if you have cable TV, I believe it was the science station. For me, I think it's channel 170. They're going to run it for, I think, about 3 hours or so as well. So even if you don't have a computer, you could get it on TV. And they're going to have Mike Massimino. He's an astronaut that comes out of Franklin Square out here on Long Island. And he's made a lot of trips. He was one of the last astronauts on a Hubble service mission back in 2009. To go up to the Hubble and work on that project on STS-125. So he's going to be doing the narration, for the people on the science station. Back to you there.
In the old days when we used to get 620 negatives on our black and white camera, in the old days they used to say stacking up with those negatives and you can make yourself a solar shield. Nowadays, they're recommending even that is not safe. And the welding shield, the welding arc gives you a whole lot of ultraviolet, so they make sure there's a good ultraviolet rejection of that welding shield. But the amount of infrared rejection is somewhat doubtful. There are people saying that even a welding shield may not be safe enough. Your welding shield has numbers like 12 or 14 to it, Paul. Any idea what the 12 or 14 means? Is there a mathematical relationship between the amount of a neutral density filtering you get versus that number? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, that was logarithmic, as I remember. So that went up. You know, each one was a power of 10. So if you get a 14, it's going to be good for the sun. But a little tough for welding. With the regular arc welding, you know, 6010 wire, which is, you know, regular steel, I was happy with a 10 or an 11. But then when I started doing the heli-arc, it's even brighter because you don't have the fumes in, you know, that arc welding has, and that creates a, you know, somewhat of like a thick cloud in front of you. So that reduces the light. So, you know, you really needed a darker lens, but then I would go up to a 13 or even a 14. Back.
So as you can tell, AC2 WB2GXM, Rich, I don't think there is a safe recipe. I'm very doubtful of that. WB2GXM, K2IW, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick. Okay, Paul. Thank you for the info, and do not fear. I'd rather be safe than blind. WB2GXM, clear.
One comment for anybody that's listening, Dick.
You got it, Paul. And after that, I'll pick up the other person who wanted to ask something. You got it, Paul.
You know, somebody might be brooding around their basement or something, and maybe their father or neighbor or somebody has a goggles with, you know, that were made for cutting steel with a torch. Those are not good. Their number's like 5. They will not work. And don't get the idea of doubling them up. Or, you know, the two lenses, put two or three together. That doesn't work either because it creates a bad double image anyway, so you're not going to see anything. Back to you, Dick.
Good recommendation to Paul. Okay, who's the other person who had a question or a comment? I think it was somebody like HUC. Give me your full call letters and name. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Kilo Delta 2, Hotel Uniform Charlie, name is Steve. And Dick, I was just curious, during the eclipse, how would that impact radio propagation, especially on HF, or will it, for that matter? Back to net.
Yeah, funny you should ask. If you Google ARRL.net, you'll find out there's a significant number of groups across the United States that are going to be running HF propagation experiments. The sun gives us a whole lot of solar wind particles, charged particles moving at roughly a million miles an hour. When they hit the ionosphere, they create ionization, and that's where your D layer, your D, E, and F layers are coming from. So when the sun is being blocked out by the moon, portions of the ionosphere are going to be not receiving that solar wind. Therefore, the amount of solar radiation of the ionosphere is going to change. So there's quite a few experiments going to be run to measure exactly that, as I see it there, Rich. That's correction, Steve. So because the main full darkening, the umbra, is only 70 miles in diameter, it is my guess that the total amount of change in propagation, unless you happen to have chosen a path that involves that 70-mile diameter of the ionosphere, it's my guess you're not going to see a great big change. But I could be wrong. That's the umbra. The penumbra, of course, is much, much larger. And maybe that amount of partial attenuation of the penumbra is more than enough to change it. I'm going to pass it back to you, Steve. Drag your feet in case there's other people who have got further information on the change in HF propagation as a function of the solar eclipse. KD2HUC to take it with a delay. K2RIW in the TechNet. Looks like we've got nobody with any further information on that one, Steve. Go ahead, Steve.
At all, because it's such going to be such a small swath affected by the eclipse. Well, I guess we'll see tomorrow. I actually took the day, and I'm going to be doing some experimenting myself, and see if there's any, you know, positive or negative impact. KD2HEC, back to net.
Okay, Steve. And by next Sunday, you'll be able to come back and tell us what you saw and what you heard by the fact you've talked to the people on the subject. Okay. One more call. Anybody have any further questions on the solar eclipse or on the space report in general? Give me your call letter and name right now if you've got any further questions, comments, or whatever. K2LIW listening.
WSON, one more comment about the next solar eclipse.
Which I think is something like 24 years, or no, wait a minute now. Vaguely I heard that the year 2024, where does that want to go from to? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, that's right, April 8th, 2024, so we got like 7 years to go. And that's good for New York, and that'll be, for us anyway, it'll be bigger than this one. This one's just over 70%. That one would be 90%. It's not going to help the other check-ins from, we had them from Kentucky and New Mexico. It's not going to be good for them, but it's good for the Northeast. And I heard all these places were booked this year down, you know, along that line from Oregon to South Carolina. So I'm thinking now, get a room already, you know, near Niagara Falls somewhere, because that's where it's going to be total 100%, you know, Buffalo and Niagara Falls, Toronto. And I got to sign up now, 7 years in advance. It was booked, they said, forever down south this year. Like, you had to do this like 6 months ago. Back to you.
The solar eclipse of 2024, where does the totality begin and where does it end? Is it a straight line or one of these curved ones? And where does it go from to, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll have to look into it. I saw it was, you know, they showed the New York area and then going up north, you know, and then gone. So I'm assuming it was out in the Atlantic. Although it might be later in the day. I didn't see the time. It's possible it might be later in the day where the sun's going to disappear over the horizon. I believe it's one of those, that which should really be cool, by the way. You know, you never know if you're going to get a cloudy day. But it looks like it's going to be good for us tomorrow. But 7 years from now, who knows? So I think it's one of those things. I think the sun's going to be lost over the horizon. Back to you.
AC2GS?
You've got it, Roy.
It is my understanding that it touched down on the United States territory in southern Texas and then makes a diagonal up to New England area and Canada.
Now, it turns out that the Earth's orbit around the Sun is slightly elliptical, and the closest we are to the Sun is in the beginning of January, which is a little bit strange, and the furthest we are from the Sun is somewhere in the middle of June. So the exact diameter that we see the Sun is a function of how close we are to it. The Moon's orbit is a lot more elliptical than our orbit around the Sun. So there are portions of time when the Moon is very close to us, it's large in diameter, and you get a really big total eclipse. Whereas there are times when, in its elliptical orbit, the Moon is further from us, and it does not thoroughly cover the Sun. Therefore, we get an annular eclipse as opposed to a total. So how big the Moon appears to us during the eclipse is the biggest variable as to whether or not you're going to get totality that lasts for 30 seconds or for 3.5 minutes, so to speak. Does anybody know how good are the mathematics for the 2024 solar eclipse. I was going to be getting some nice long periods of totality or very brief periods of totality. Does anybody know? K2IIW listening.
I don't know yet. I don't even have the time on it yet, Dick. But now, if you miss that one, you got to wait till 2033 and go up to Alaska. Back to you, Dick.
AC2GS again?
You got it, Roy.
Actually, a fairly nice graphic that shows the path of different total eclipses that are going to crisscross around North America. Unfortunately, I do not have the web page. If anyone wants to email me, I can send them a copy of the image.
And what's the easiest way that somebody can find your email address so they can send something to you? Roy, go ahead.
Well, interesting. I have to see if I programmed it in here. You know, I'm running in with a TMV-71. It's a dual-band radio. And when I programmed it, I went on Echolink. Echolink. I went on Chirp, and I did a proximity search.
Anyway, you could either look me up in QRZ, or I'll make it even easier for everyone. If they put anything in the front part, and then at the end say, at AlphaCharlie2GolfSierra.com, it'll come to me.
Very good, Paul. So, once again, for somebody who sends you an email, you are offering to send them what in return? Go ahead, Roy.
Graphic that I found on the web that shows the next, say, I forget, I think it's the next, for the rest of this century, the eclipses that will touch down on any part of U.S. territory.
And if the graphic was done accurately, by way of the stripe on the ground of totality, you can get a hint as to how long you're going to be seeing totality. This particular one that's going to happen tomorrow gives you a full umbra that's roughly 70 miles in diameter, maybe it's 71 miles in diameter. So if the graphic is done accurately, you can sense a very narrow strip or a very wide strip of the stripe across the United States where the totality is going to be observable. And it's nice to find one with a nice wide dark area, because that's going to be a longer total eclipse. Okay. Anyway, any further questions or comments from all of the above, give me a call letters right now. Even a late check-in. K2IW and a TechNet. Okay, I heard KD2IDC, I think it was. Very weak audio, very weak RF. Sounded like Kilo Delta 2, India Delta Charlie. Please correct me and give me your name. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Kilo Delta 2, India Victor Zulu. My name is Nick.
Okay, that time I heard India, Victor, Zulu, and it sounded like your name is Nick, N-I-C-K. Is that true, Nick? Go ahead.
That's correct. I'm talking my bail bank tonight, so I apologize. I'm in Ridgewood, Queens, and apparently I'm not hitting the repeater too well.
Yeah, your signal is very noisy, and part of the confusion is that when you move your handy turkey to the place where you get the strongest reception, that's not necessarily the place where you give the strongest transmission, because the transmitting frequency is 600 KC different. So if you move to a different place, it's possible we'll hear a stronger transmission from you. Over to you, Nick, K2RIW.
Okay, well, I'll make it three. I am working outside tomorrow all day. Is there any danger if I accidentally look up at the sun for a split second while working?
I think the answer is no. Lots and lots of people have caught the sun out of the corner of their eye and looked at it for a very brief period of time. My understanding is that the damage to the retina is thermal damage. So a well-focused sun spot onto the retina creates extreme heating that creates damage. So if you're going to look at the sun for a fraction of a second, I think that that doesn't create damage. But I could be wrong on that one. Anybody on frequency have got some further comments on this? K2RIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Paul.
I think it's called natural aversion. Animals have it, dogs, you know, they just don't look at at something if it's too bright, and we have it too. And the problem is with the eclipse, you know, somebody doesn't believe in any kind of shade looking at it, any kind of filter. You know, they overcome that by staring at it, and they're overcoming that natural aversion to look away. So, you know, that happens all the time. You know, you're driving and you're looking up into the sun. Sure, it's bright coming in your window, but it's got a lot of atmosphere in a way when it's low in the horizon. But when it's above you, you know, you're looking up, and how many times you're on a beach or on a chair or out in the backyard and you're looking up in the air, and you look away real quick. It's not going to bother you. Now they say there's going to be less damage with an eclipse because it's going to be blocking out some of that sun, especially here, about 70%. So it shouldn't be a problem. You don't want to just stare at it for, you know, any longer than a second or two. That's the best way. Don't try to look at it. That's number one, because it does take a few seconds, and you could do some damage to your retina. Back to you, Dick.
I'm going to correct a possible misinterpretation of what Paul just said. The fact that 73% or something like that of the sun is going to be blocked out for our location during the peak of the eclipse. A naive person would say, hey, only nearly 30% is left over, therefore it's safe. Don't believe it. So that amount that's left is well beyond the point where if you stare at it for a long enough period of time, you will do eye damage. A second of staring at the sun, I think your eye will tolerate that, but don't push it. Make sure you got the right kind of eye protection material, or use some form of solar projection, a pinhole in a cardboard box, so to speak, will project the sun onto the back wall of the box, and that's one way of safely looking at the sun. And some small telescopes, you can let the sun shine through the telescope, and what comes out of the eyepiece is safe. Small telescopes. The large telescope and a modern-day eyepiece, you can still do damage to the eyepiece, as well as the spotting scope that's there. I'm going to turn it back to Nick. KD2, India Victor Zulu, K2RIW. Go ahead, Nick.
Yeah, I'm not interested in looking at it at all tomorrow. I just want to get through the day working without hurting myself. So I appreciate that. Thank you. 73.
Yeah, the danger of looking at the sun is the same every single day, Nick. There are people who think there's something special about a solar eclipse. The problem with the solar eclipse is now the moon is going to take a bite out of the sun, and now people want to look at those details, and therefore they're staring at the sun for a long period of time. They've got to do it with protection. The telescope filter that I own is made by the Bader company, B-A-A-D-E-R. I think it's a German company. And it's an 8-inch diameter filter that I've got that goes on the front of my 8-inch diameter telescope. What's interesting about that filter is that you can put it on the telescope, and get a nice picture of the sun. I can put it on a telescope of any other size. I can put it in front of my binoculars, and it gives me just the right amount of illumination from my binoculars. I can hold it in front of my face and look through that filter and look at the sun, and it gives me just the right amount of attenuation. Until you go through the mathematics, it's kind of hard to believe that whether you've got something as small as the couple of millimeters of the iris of an eye, or the 35 or 50 millimeters diameter of a set of binoculars, or the 8-inch diameter of a telescope, that the exact same filter is the exact same amount, the exact amount of filtering, the amount of neutral density attenuation. Let me drop.
Query, CPG.
Okay. APG, I think it was. The reason why the bigger aperture telescope, gathering much more of the solar light coming through that 8-inch diameter filter, is still the right amount is because you run that larger telescope at a higher gain number. Call it a small... Call it a...
Repeater, timeout.
Call it a higher F number, if you like, because you're running at the gain of 50 or 100, which cuts down the amount of light left over after the magnification. That's what makes it safe. Your eye has no gain. The binoculars have a gain of 7. The telescope has got a gain of 70, and therefore it all works out just right. N2APG, K2LIW, I think it's you, Dave. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's me, N2APG. Just a quick question, a little speculation. What would happen if you used your telescope, and in front of your telescope, instead of using the filter material, instead of that, what if you used a pinhole barrier in front of your telescope, such as a cardboard with a pinhole in it, or aluminum foil with a pinhole in it? Would that possibly work at all to see the ecliptic, or to see the sun, even on a regular day?
If the pinhole is small enough, would it be safe? Yes. The next question is, what kind of an image are you going to get? There, I don't know. That's an interesting question. A pinhole in front of a telescope. There are various devices you can buy for your telescope, which is an aperture with a couple of holes in the aperture, and you put that in front of the scope, and that allows you to do certain things. I remember putting a pinhole in a piece of paper in front of my 35-millimeter camera with a 50-millimeter lens. I remember carefully setting that up along at the edge of my wooden picnic table. And so I set it up so that the image began right at the crack between two boards of the picnic table. And so because the pinhole was so small, I was really running a F200, so to speak. Let me drop. And it was a time exposure, so that the small amount of light still gave me full exposure to the film. What was unique about that picture is that everything was in focus. Everything from a quarter inch in front of the lens to infinity. In the background, after looking at the crack between the two boards of the picnic table, I could see trees and other things in the background. So that picture has an extremely high F number picture with extreme depth of field. Everything's in focus. So I think you're going to see a similar phenomena with a pinhole in front of your telescope. I may try that. That sounds like fun. Where'd you get the idea for that one, Dave? N2APG, K2LIW?
Well, I just thought of it. The projection method is, probably the preferred safe method to, to view the sun, to watch the eclipse. And of course, if you really want to be on the safe side, just turn your TV on, because all the major networks are going to be, having all sorts of wonderful live coverage of the eclipse. And, I'm sure they're sparing no expense as far as, what they're going to be showing, the equipment that they're using. So that's probably the best view that you're going to get. Of course, it's not, you know, first person, but that's probably going to be...